For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, well, we might as well get started. Looks like we have an intimate group. That's good. You'll be able to ask questions and hopefully understand this topic a little bit when we finish. But starting the conversation is the title of this lecture. It really brings up this whole issue of how we deal with each other at the end of life. And the reason I raise this issue, I've written a book about it and try to get out and speak and get this out into the public eye and in medicine for education, is that we're really behind the curve on helping people understand what happens at the end of life, what their choices are, basically how to die well. And the reason I raise it is because my medical job is an inpatient internal medicine, which means non-surgical. Therefore, we treat a lot of people at the end of their life. And a common experience, and it probably happens about 80% of the time, people come into the hospital, they have a serious illness. Because of that illness, they lack the capacity to make a decision for themselves. Someone has to decide what to do for them, and inevitably they choose heroic measures that prolong their life, in some cases at a futile way. In other words, there's no hope of meaningful survival, and yet we spend a lot of effort, resources, and the worst part is the people suffer so much of the time. And so that's what we're going to take up here, is this whole issue. And the reason I raise it is because it's something that's not getting better. I think it's getting worse. In fact, I call it the perfect storm that we have on the horizon here, because we have healthcare technology that's, I mean, it's pretty good. We can keep someone alive. We can keep the beating heart going. We can keep breathing with machines, with medicines, with procedures. And yet, the quality of life is not good for a lot of people. I'll just give you an example. We had a patient that had an elderly person, like around 80 years old. She couldn't really get around well before all this. She got an infection in a joint, then she got infection in her whole body. She developed multi-system organ failure, which means that she couldn't keep a blood pressure. She was on dialysis full time. She was on a breathing machine, and she needed high doses of medicines to keep her blood pressure going. It's futile. I mean, everyone knows that deals with this kind of thing, she will die. And yet her family requested that we just keep doing everything. And I think it's just because they didn't understand. We have this idea that more is better. And if we don't do, what are you trying to do? You're just trying to push her out. You're trying to save money. Or what's really going on here? This went on for 3 weeks. 3 weeks. Medicines, drugs. Her mouth was torn apart. She was bleeding. You could tell she was in pain. It just prolonged her suffering. But that happens. You go into any hospital that takes care of ICU patients, and you can see bed after bed after bed filled with patients just like that. ICUs used to be places where people sort of got saved. They got rescued. Now it's a place where people linger, mostly. A few people get rescued there. Most people linger there. It's not good. So healthcare technology is good on one hand, but not so good on the other. We have an aging population. That's why I say this problem is getting worse, not better. Now, this is true. It may seem hard to believe, but between now and 20 years, 2030, the population over age 65 will double. We have a population bubble coming into that age, and we have increased life expectancy. So it's going to get bigger and bigger, the people in this category. So we need to deal with them in the right way. And there's misinformation. In other words, people just don't understand. In fact, they believe myths about what happens at the end of life, brought on by watching too much TV. And I'll give you some specific examples of that. Then, of course, who wants to talk about death? Nobody does. Doctors don't even talk about death to their patients when they should. And families are all over the world, and so they don't come together and talk about it. But what I'd like you to do is just imagine this. You've lived a good long life. You've got a chronic illness. You're facing the end of your life. What would you like that to be like? Just think. Where would you be? Who would be with you? What kind of medical care would you have? Well, here's what people, when we've polled them, people with a serious illness, here's what they'd like. They'd like their pain controlled. They don't want prolongation of the dying process. When it's my time to go, when my heart stops, let it stop. They'd like to have a sense of, they would like to call the shots. I mean, we'd all like to call the shots, right? They'd like to relieve the burdens on their family so that the burden is on me, my family knows what I want, I don't want them to suffer needlessly through this process. They'd like to strengthen their relationship. They'd like to be with their loved ones. That's why most people say they'd like to be at home for this process. This was published in a journal of the American Medical Association. Good journal. Well, that's what people want. It makes sense, right? I mean, when all of you sat here and you had a chronic illness and you think, what would I want at the end of life? How many people thought I'd like to be in a hospital? How many people thought I'd like to be in an ICU? How many people thought I'd like to be on a ventilator? I'd like to have CPR as my parting shot for the world. Nobody wants that. Now, if I dropped dead right now, if I had a cardiac arrhythmia and dropped dead, I'd hope you'd resuscitate me. I mean, there'd be a good chance not a good chance, but a better chance for survival of that kind of a situation. I mean, I believe in resuscitation and have resuscitated a lot of people and helped a lot of people in that way. And yet, there comes a time when we realize that the return is so low, but people don't know that. I'm not saying that I or you or anyone should call the shots, or a death panel, as they say. It should say, this person, it's no for this one, yes for this one. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about self-determination. In other words, each person gets to decide. That's not what happens, because we don't talk about it. People come into the healthcare system. They can't make a decision. Their family says, go ahead and do everything, because they don't know. They feel guilty about it. And here's what people get. People with a serious illness at the end of life, this is what they get. In this study, half had severe pain in the last 3 days. What was the top thing people wanted? Symptom control, pain control. But half of the people with chronic severe illnesses at the end of life, they didn't get even that. 38% who died in this study spent more than 10 days in the ICU, in a coma, or on a ventilator. How many of them would have wanted that? I'd say less than 5%. I mean, there are some people, and if that's what they want, that's okay. I mean, there are some people that just the way they look at life, they think, I want every beat possible. Every tick of the watch, I'll take. I just, want to cling to life like that. That's okay if that's what you want. Some people even spiritualize it and say, well, we don't want to take it out of God's hands, so we need to do everything and God will take her or him at that time. I don't agree with that perspective necessarily. If that's what you believe, I don't care. But let's state it and let's let people speak for themselves. Because what we find here is people are not getting what they want. Yeah.
But isn't that all going to tie into what's on paper as far as the law and having stated that in a legal way?
Yeah, and we're going to get to that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that people can determine it in advance, but we have to have a system that lets people know that they need to do that. Because here's the problem then. People receive care that they decline if we give them the opportunity. And what happens? First of all, the patients suffer. A lot of people suffer needlessly at the end of life with all these treatments that just prolong their death. But there's another thing, and that is that the decision maker, the person that has to make a decision for them, they suffer too. And this is a recent study, okay? This was just last fall, or this spring, March 2011, Annals of Internal Medicine. This was an NIH-funded study where they reviewed thousands of, studies. It was a review article, so there were thousands of patient records analyzed for this study. There's the title, Systematic Review, The Effect on Surrogates of making treatment decisions. A surrogate is someone who makes a decision for someone else. So what was the emotional impact of having to make this kind of a decision? Here's the problem. Many adult patients, including most of those at the end of life, cannot make their own treatment decisions. Up to 40% of all hospitalized adults, 70% of older adults, this was like over 70, and 95% of critically ill adults. So that means it's not that they have dementia coming in, it's that their illness is severe, so they're either incapacitated or they're delirious. To have capacity, there's kind of a medical legal definition. To have capacity for a decision, you have to understand. Informed consent is the risk, the benefits, and the alternatives. And to demonstrate capacity, you have to be able to reiterate it and show that you really understand it. So it takes a fairly complicated cognition to be able to do that. And you can imagine if you're coming in and your oxygen levels are low because you have a pneumonia and your blood pressure is low, and these kind of, you don't have capacity. So who does that fall to then? It falls to a surrogate. And the surrogate order in Ohio is spouse first and then children based on the oldest one first. If you do not designate a decision maker, that's the order. And so when I'm in the intensive care unit with this person, we have to make decisions. We've got to decide on treatments. There has to be consent to administer these treatments and procedures. So we go find the surrogate decision maker and we ask them, what should we do? So what do you think happens to these people? It's not good. It's not good. These are the authors of this paper. Here's the findings. A third of surrogate decision makers experience stress, anxiety, or other emotional burden as a result of making or helping to make treatment decisions for an incapacitated adult. I mean, that's substantial. So 80% of people don't have a designated surrogate decision maker. So 4 out of 5 people that come into the hospital in this kind of condition, somebody's going to have to make a decision. How many thousand do you think that is every day? Thousands. Now you take a third of those surrogate decision makers, every day are going to face emotional turmoil up to and including post-traumatic stress disorder from this experience, and we just let it happen. It happens every day. This is just a new study. This is a whole nother dimension of this problem, that these people are being so adversely affected. The amazing thing is, and they make this point too, the emotional burden placed on the decision maker could impair their judgment so that their decisions might not be the patient's best interest. In other words, they're pressured and they may not be even rational about this and even able to do what they think might be the best thing for the patient. But check this out. Most important, the data provide compelling evidence that knowing the patient's treatment preferences substantially influence the effect on surrogates. This is a quote from the paper. So what's he saying? If the person designated a decision maker, in Ohio we call that a healthcare power of attorney, if they made that designation and that surrogate knew what their loved one wanted, there was hardly any problem. Because you know what they said? They had these qualitative studies too. They said things like, I knew I just was doing the best thing for him. I knew that's what he wanted. Are you bothered by it? I'm bothered in the usual way of grief, but I'm not torn with guilt. You see, that's the problem. People feel guilty. They feel guilty if they withdraw care or don't give as much care. They feel guilty if they give a lot of care because they look and they see them, they visit their loved one on the ventilator struggling and they know they're suffering on the ventilator. They're thinking, is this what they would have really wanted? I don't know. I'm just trying to do the best thing. So it's lose-lose, whether they do more or whether they do less. They feel guilty. A third of them suffer substantially. So this is big deal. This is one of these hidden sort of social issues that is getting worse all the time. Yeah, like I said, the population over 65 is going to double between now and 2030. Yep. All right. There's another point, and that is that society suffers. And society suffers because this care which people would refuse if given the opportunity, costs so much. You know, every day in an ICU is thousands of dollars. Here's the financial cost. 30% of Medicare is spent on the last year of life. That sort of varies year to year, but that's accurate. That might be the upper. Maybe it's 27, 28, 29, around 30%. Half of that is spent in the last 60 days of life. 15% in the last 2 months of life. Now, I know you probably don't carry these figures around with you in your head, but 15% of Medicare, what do you think that is? She's reading off the notes. $70 billion.
Is that just conventional hospital medical care, or does that include hospice care?
Anything that would build a Medicare. So hospice would be billed to Medicare. You know what it doesn't include? It doesn't include Medicaid. By 2040, half the state revenue in Ohio will pay for nursing homes through Medicaid. I think what you see is it's not sustainable. It's not. I mean, it is if we want to develop some other sort of shift in spending, we want to increase tax. I mean, there are ways, but as a community, as a society, we've got decisions that we have to make with regard to this. And I think that an issue here that you have to bring in is that, you know, some people say, well, what are you doing? Are you putting a price on a life? Are you putting a price on hours of life? Maybe. But what I am advocating for is that each of us, each of you, each person in our culture, they get a chance to decide. Because what I'm saying, and I think I'm going to be able to demonstrate to you, is that people would want less than they're getting at the end. A lot of people dying in nursing homes or between the hospital and the nursing home. All right, so I'll stop there and see if any of you have any questions so far. Nothing? Yeah, Marilyn? Well, I'm going to talk about hospice a little later. Maybe I can answer some of your questions. But I think when it comes to the expense, it's very difficult. It's a good issue to get out and start to talk about. And some of the things that you really have to bring into the discussion, because there are some people on one end of the spectrum that have this idea that we disrespect life if we don't prolong it as long as possible. Okay? I'm just telling you, that's one perspective. I feel like we respect life by letting people self-determine in a way that they decide when enough's enough. I'm not saying that we kill them. I don't believe in euthanasia and all these kind of things where you put an end to somebody's life. But there is a certain point where you realize that the quality of life is so diminished, and the only reason that we can sustain this person is because of technology. It's all external. And I think at those points when we say, let's just let them die naturally if that's what they want. And so this camp that says, okay, we value life so much that we value it to this extent, it doesn't matter what it costs. My first question is, how do you value the life of the person that lives here that has hypertension and diabetes that can't afford their medicine? You never speak for them. They don't. These people that are banging the drum for every minute of life at the end have nothing or very little often to say about the person with diabetes and hypertension, that if we gave them $8 a month and a doctor's visit twice a year, we could prolong their life for years and probably prevent strokes, heart attacks, and all kinds of things that are going to cost us tons of money. But we're so daggone short-sighted, we can't look at this. All we can see is this. And what I'm saying is, if we gave people an opportunity to self-determine and say no to this, there would be a huge chunk to help these people here that are poor, that are uninsured, that have simple and treatable problems. We got to bring the whole thing.
Once said to me, there are things worse than death. And I think that's part of what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah.
Since he said that to me, I haven't been able to forget it. I would think that one of those things is that's something that's worse than death.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and here we are, as Christians, what do we have to fear in death? We realize that this life it's short. I mean, what's this compared to eternity? What do I have to fear when it's my time? You know, I don't want to push it. Man, I'm ready to go. I don't think he's ready to take me yet, but when it comes to that time, it's like, come on. And so I think that's the other thing, that from a spiritual standpoint, we should be ready to go in a way. AJ?
Do physicians or other medical professionals ever have the opportunity to say we're going to stop care? For example, like that woman who was on end-of-life care for 3 weeks, is there ever a point where you tell the family, it's a good time to stop this, or how does that work out?
Well, we talk to patients and their families. In this case, the patient didn't have capacity to decide. But we talk to the family regularly, so much so that they got angry at a certain point and said, you know, this was before I was on the case, but they said, don't talk to them about this because they think we're trying to pull the plug. And they're angry about that. Now, in Ohio, it's not real easy to do this, but in some states, there's a law, and actually we could do this in Ohio, but it's no one hardly will do it. I've only done it one time. It's when two physicians agree that it's medically futile. They do not have to take care of the patient. In other words, they can say, we feel like ethically this is beyond us, and they could request the family find another physician, or they stop care. That's called medical futility. So you can make a case for that, but it's not done very often because, I mean, you know, everybody's afraid they're going to get sued. So, yeah, there's a one over here. Oh, go ahead.
What is the DNR order fit into?
I'm going to get to that. That's a very important part of this discussion. Do not resuscitate order. Good. Other questions? Okay. Well, the way I like to frame this is in terms of what we call informed consent. Informed consent and end-of-life care. Now, when you go for a surgical procedure or anything in medicine, really when you take a medicine, you should receive this information: the benefits, the risks, the alternatives. What good will this do me? What bad could this do me? And what else could I do? Are there other ways to deal with this matter? And this is good informed consent. And what I'm going to show you is that this is needed because our public is so misinformed about this whole issue. I call it the information gap. Now, here's the situation. Here's what they studied. So they took patients in the hospital, over 70, with a complicating medical factor. So they say they had pneumonia, or they had congestive heart. They're sick enough at that age to be hospitalized on a medical service. This is not like they're in for knee surgery or something like this. They're medically ill. In the hospital, and the question is simple. If your heart stopped and we had to resuscitate you, what do you think the chances are that you would survive and you would be discharged from the hospital? What do you think the chances are? And you just mull that over in your mind. If they went into cardiac arrest, they're in the hospital, over 70 with a medical problem, and their heart stops.
Only 70?
No. Yeah. I know. I know. Only 70.
93.
Yeah.
So far, she's great.
Yeah.
But that 70 kind of gets.
I know. Well, here's the deal. 83% of people over age 70 believe they've got a 50% or greater chance of surviving CPR to discharge. Okay, and like I said, this is medical patient. If you're in a cath, you're having a cardiac cath, and you're having a heart attack, and your heart stops there, there's a good chance. But here's what they're 50%. You know what the truth is right here? It's 5%. 5%. So it's like a tenfold difference. Some of the studies as low as zero. You think, why? I thought medicine was a lot better than that. Why is it only 5%? Well, it's telling you something. If you've got a medical problem and your heart stops, what's that mean? You're really sick. Yeah. And the problem with this is, two, of the ones that make it and get discharged, about 40% have a big stroke. Who's telling anybody about this? You know what they did? They went back and they asked the people, so where do you get your medical information? Well, where do you think?
Online.
TV. Not the American Medical Association. That's the problem. They get their information from TV. So they went back and they looked at the TV shows. You know, like all the reality TV shows and all that. And in those shows, about 67% of people that needed CPR survived. So the people were accurately reflecting what they learned through the mythology of television. You see? And that's why this study is called Miracles and Misinformation. It's a good study. Published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So, that's what, you see, these are the things that people don't, I mean, if you realize this was the case, then you'd plan for it better. You'd say, you know, if it comes to that, I don't want that, or, you know, at least don't prolong it, maybe give me one shot, and I don't want to be on the, and they talk to their family about it, so their family knows what they want. You see, that's the best protection. If you talk to your family, you protect them. If you talk to the family, you protect you. Because now they know what you want. And they can make a decision for you.
If the doctor doesn't have a legal document?
No, you talk to your family and you document it on a health care power of attorney.
Oh, you're back there, yes.
Yeah, okay. And we'll get to that. Okay, yeah, because we don't want to get into that problem like a lot of families do. Here's a big problem, though. 20 to 30% of these people whose heart stopped, they get a heartbeat back enough to, then they go on a breathing machine, they'll need medicines, and then they linger for a long time, often before they pass. But most of these, only one in six of these will make it, and half of those will have a stroke. See, this doesn't make good TV. You know, if you're on Grey's Anatomy and you lose 95% of your people, man, your ratings drop. You know, you're supposed to be heroes and saving lives and making money and all that kind of thing. Well, with this kind of thing, you just can't, it just doesn't work. for older people very well. All right, now here's another thing that really illustrates the problems. Now I ask you this question: if you had advanced dementia, lived in a nursing home, and developed pneumonia, what would you prefer? So this is the level of dementia in this study that they looked at. It's called the level 6 needing help feeding. So in bed, in diapers, no memory. So if someone comes in and sees you and they walk out, you say, oh, hi, how are you today? Because you don't remember them, if you're even that verbal. Okay, probably not that verbal at a level 6. And you need help eating. So you can't feed yourself, someone feeds you. Diapers, no memory, in bed, need help feeding. If you were in that condition, and you were in a nursing home, and you got a pneumonia, which is potentially going to kill you, this could be the end for you, what would you want? Two choices I give you. Take me to the hospital, treat me, then bring me back to the nursing home. I see some people grimacing and shaking their heads. I mean, what are most people going to want? Don't hospitalize me. Keep me comfortable. Let me go. It's the end. I'm demented. It's not even me anymore, probably, is the way a lot of us look at it. Okay, so they just released a study where they asked this question of people. And they enhanced the education by using a video of what it means to have severe dementia. So they asked people before they got into the case of severe dementia. 86% said all they would want is comfort care. That makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, you look around at Americans or anyone in the Western world, and how many people look at someone in that condition, a relative, and they say, man, if I'm at that point, just let me go. You see, I see patients like this all the time. All the time. Because in a nursing home, if they get pneumonia, you know what the nursing home's worried about? If they don't have a do not hospitalize order? They're worried about getting sued. Because you're not supposed to take care of pneumonia in the nursing home, you know. You've got to take care of that in the hospital. It's an acute medical problem. So what do they do? Right to the hospital. And now, this patient's, their setting has changed. They're oftentimes agitated. They have to be restrained. It's horrible. But when you get old and you have dementia like this, everybody aspirates. You get some of your food, doesn't go into your stomach, all you get it into your lungs, so you get pneumonia. It always happens. And yet I saw a patient who had 5 admissions for aspiration pneumonia in 6 months. And I sat down with his wife and his daughter were there. And I'm like, you know, this is just gonna keep happening. And it's not really benefiting. Is this what he would want? And his wife said, oh no, he wouldn't want this. And I thought, oh, here's a breakthrough. And I said, well, you know, we can change that. And we could just let him pass naturally, keep him comfortable. Oh, she says, oh no, I couldn't stand that.
So it's horrible.
Oh yeah. I'm like, my gosh, what did she have against this poor old guy? You know, she wants to torture him for a few more months or whatever and bring him back and forth to the hospital because she just can't stand to let him go. Even though in her hearts of hearts and in her head, she knows that's not even what he would want. So it's too bad. Well, in 2007, they did a study on this. They looked at this population and they asked the question, how many of these patients in nursing homes with severe dementia have do not hospitalize comfort care orders? Because it is an order, it's a designation, has to be discussed with the family. The doctor writes it, do not hospitalize comfort care. The one study showed 86% of people would want comfort care. Only what? 14% at most would want care at that point. And a lot of that was limited care. Here's what it is. This is America today. 7.1% of nursing home patients with advanced dementia have do not hospitalize orders. Okay? Level 6, need help feeding. In our nursing homes in America today, when they get pneumonia, 92.9% of them will be taken to a hospital. It's pitiful. It's pitiful. Because it's not what people would want. And it costs so much money. And it hurts the patient. It hurts the patient because, like I said, they're disoriented, they're restrained, they're delirious. And it goes on again and again and again in many cases. So this, I think, shows us that we got a big problem. We got a big problem. I used this slide this morning to make a similar point. And that is, we need to change. We've made changes before. Can we do it now? What I want you to think about is how you might be able to start this kind of a conversation with people in your church, in your family, and that kind of thing. Because, frankly, the medical community is not making much headway on this. I've had a couple of breakthroughs recently, possibly with some people, but I don't think much is going to happen. We can't wait for the government. Politicians are afraid. You know, they're afraid to do much of substance because they need to get reelected. And so something like this takes some guts, you know, to wade into an issue like this. And I don't see any much in the way of guts out there in politics right now. So what we need to do is have conversations. Some people are reluctant to have conversations. They think, oh, that's going to discourage my loved one or something like that. Well, conversations about goals improve quality and reduce costs. And what they did in this study is they looked at 322 seriously ill cancer patients who had a conversation about prognosis and goals. And these people had this kind of an outcome. They had a better quality, and that means they had less pain, less symptoms during their dying times. Better quality of death. They had lower risk of complicated grief in the family. This goes just along with that other study we showed, that the family knew what they wanted. They worked together as a team. These people had less aggressive care, and they had lower cost of care. So isn't it interesting? They got what they wanted, the family did better, and it cost less. What did it take, though? How did we get to this point? Time. You see, and in medicine, as in every place, time is what? Money. Who has time to do this? Well, nobody's taking time to do it right now. It's just not getting done. The people that this was naturally fall to would be what we call our primary care providers. Our primary care providers are grossly underpaid by Medicare. You know how much a primary care visit gets paid for about a one-hour visit? $112. It might have gone up. That was a 2009 number. You think $112 an hour, that's good pay. That is for everything. Every bit of overhead and the doctor's salary. So if I had a wallet in my pocket and a Medicare patient came in my office and I spent an hour with them, I might as well just take money out and start peeling it out. You got malpractice insurance, you got your rent, you got your nurse, you got your front office, you got your utilities. A friend of mine, one of the best guys in my medical school class, went into general internal medicine, practiced in Bellevue, Ohio. We graduated in 1984 from medical school. He did his residency, went right into that practice. He's a great doctor, so he kept all of his patients practically. They never wanted to leave him. So 2 years ago, 75% of his practice was Medicare, and they went broke. And he had to leave that practice. You see, that's the reality of the situation. Primary care doctors can't make it taking care of Medicare patients. Because they're not paid properly to do it. Then when legislation proposes that they pay doctors to have end-of-life discussions, was in the legislation 2 years ago, it was called what? A death panel. You know that? Did any of you ever read the legislation? It was called a death panel. I read it all. It was to pay primary care doctors to have an end-of-life discussion to let people know what their options were at the end of life. And that became twisted into this whole thing that, no, somebody out there is going to decide when to pull the plug on granny. You know, it's politics. That's why we can't look, I think, to the government to solve this problem. They're just not going to do it. Because, you know, something that's as touchy as this, that could get a big part of the population, this swelling group of people over 65, we want to get their votes. So we want to be their advocates. So what are we going to do? We're going to keep them in ignorance. That's what we're going to do. And get their votes.
But it, there again, it goes back to politics, and you're caught in a vicious circle, because once you turn 65 and you have no other way to get insurance, Medicare is your insurance.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, as you said, some doctors, some doctors who have made, quote, their money, they can easily refuse Medicare patients.
Oh, yeah.
Where,
and they do.
And then other doctors are just doing it because it's not paying well.
Uh-huh.
But that also causes then the person who put into that program, and I speak from experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that is not going to end without something major happening.
No. No, it's not. But see, here's the thing, though. If we had clear-headed thinking on this issue, remember that figure I put up, $70 billion in the last 60 days of life? I'm telling you, a lot of that care is totally futile. And care that people would... You know how long it takes you to get $1 trillion at $70 billion a year? What, about 13 years or something like that? That's $1 trillion. Just in those last... And that's getting bigger. It's got to get bigger because we're not dealing with this issue and the population surging into this. But to answer your question, how's Medicare going to work? We got to deal with these things. It's the only way. And I think it's like this. They had a better quality. They talked about it. They got what they wanted. It was a better quality of life and death. Their families did better, and it cost less. But we got to be willing to talk about death. All right. So if we talk about this in terms of informed consent, the benefits, the risks, I talked to you about some of the statistics here. But the question, what are some of the alternatives in the face of serious illness? Because today, most people think what's better is to have more care. The more care is better care. And it's true to a certain extent, maybe, but what are some of the alternatives? If I'm I have a chronic illness, I'm reaching the end of my life, what else could I do? And one of the words that, or terms you need to learn is palliative care. By definition, symptom management care. So if you have severe lung disease, what's going to happen to you at the end of your life? You're going to get short of breath, you're going to wheeze and struggle, and that's going to be how life ends. Well, we can do things to give you relief of that feeling of breathlessness to make your end better. I mean, dying is bad. It's painful. It's terrible. But we can mitigate some of those symptoms. That's palliative care. And a subset of palliative care is hospice care. Hospice is better and better known, started back in the 60s, but this is a subset of palliative care. It's focused on people who have a terminal illness. They have less than 6 months to live, as determined by two physicians. Of course, who knows for sure? But if two physicians agree this person has less than 6 months to live and they do not want to seek life-prolonging care. So, for example, you have cancer that's throughout your body. You realize, I'm not going to take chemotherapy or anything anymore. I want to accept the end. And I want to be as comfortable as possible, then I can go into hospice. It doesn't have to be cancer. It can be lung disease. It can be congestive heart failure. And here's the one of the craziest things about hospice care. A lot of people think you go into hospice care to die. There are three different diagnoses that people live longer in hospice. With congestive heart failure, they live longer. With lung disease, they live longer. And with a couple of different kinds of cancer, they live longer in hospice. Why? Why do people live longer in hospice? Because...
I think it's because I read this expression in a book I read. The more people around a bed, a dying person, the better chance they have of living.
Hmm.
And I would guess that in hospice, you're having a caring person, someone, and you're having... You're getting good feelings that you're being cared for in an extra way, I would say.
Yeah. I think that contributes. The thing is, most hospice care is in the home. It's not in a hospice center. It's in the home. And so, one, they're in their home. They feel better about being in their home. They don't get as depressed as being in a hospital setting. They have their family around them. That encourages them. But then they have a nurse or a professional from the healthcare team with hospice that checks on them regularly. So with someone like with congestive heart failure, it's all about managing fluid levels. Too much salt, too much water, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Well, if a nurse comes in and they see him, they have him hop on, oh, you picked up a couple pounds, take an extra dose of your diuretic. They're not going to get that. Or even just reminding them to take their medicines. They live longer in hospice. So it's not like hospice is the kiss of death. That's right. You're not in the hospital, so you're not around the germs. But the other thing is you're not undergoing the procedures. If you take another dose of chemotherapy, what's that going to do to your blood counts? It's going to drop them, your immunity drops, and you get infections, and you die. So there are alternatives. And I think hospice is way underutilized. I think palliative care is way underutilized. That there are so many people. You see, severe dementia is a terminal disease. That level 6 dementia we talked about, life expectancy for 6 months is less than 50%. And so we need to consider it like that. Those patients would be great hospice candidates. And that's what I try to do. When I get a patient like that in the hospital, I'm like, here's what I'd like you to consider. Hospice for your loved ones. And, you know, those people that embrace that, their families do better, the patients do better. It's just all around better experience. All right, so let's talk then about what we can do here to help people. These are called advanced directives. That's when people can speak in advance for what they want. Here's a little cartoon. It says, his last request was that we close the casket before you begin. So he planned ahead anyway, right? Most people don't plan it out this well. But I want to talk about some of the key advanced directives. Do any of you live outside Ohio? Okay, we have a few. Okay, well, I'm going to tell you pretty much what it is like in Ohio, but your state could well be different.
Well, we've had a trust for many, many years, and we recently moved to Indiana from Tennessee, and in that trust is the power of attorney for health care and financial and all of that, along with anytime my husband and I have surgery, we take the letter in, it's filed with the hospital.
Uh-huh.
So that they have it on file. If anything happens to us in that surgery, they know that we don't want any extraordinary measures for our lives. But because we moved while we were purchasing our new home, I asked the attorney in that situation, because we have a trust that covers just about everything, is that trust still applicable in the state of Indiana now? And he said, if it was a well-written trust, and I believe it was, you should be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to check back.
Yeah, it would be worth, I mean, if you have a living will in Ohio, it's just the laws of the land in the United States. If one state recognizes a document, another state must recognize it. But now if you're a resident, that may be different. Since you're no longer a resident of Tennessee, I don't know. But I think it's worth checking out.
That it will work, but that would be a good point to clear up now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, here's the document that we have in Ohio. First, it's called a living will. And this document states what you would want in the case that you're in a terminally unconscious state or have a terminal condition. So it only works in those. And so the things that it stipulates, like, do you want CPR? Do you want to be on a ventilator? Do you want to have tube feedings? And so it gives somebody the opportunity, if I'm in a permanently unconscious state, in other words, like a vegetative state, we call that sometimes, then you can designate, don't do anything extra. Let me go. That's the living will. Same thing if you have a terminal condition, that will be in force. The next document is the healthcare power of attorney. This assigns someone to make decisions for you if you can't. In Ohio, I think this is the most important document. Two reasons. One, in families, they got their loved one, they come in, then there's the son and the daughter, and you know what? They can't agree. What's it do to their relationship? They're at odds with each other, it degrades it. I've seen families ripped apart in the ICU waiting room, fighting over what dad would want. And all dad had to do, if he would have known it and someone would have sat him down with this kind of a conversation, all dad would have had to do is say, listen, if I'm on the ventilator, this is what I want. If it's his belief he wants to have everything done, he tells him, do everything. I want every beat this old heart will give me. And they can then, in a clear conscience, they say, give it to him. You know, but then on the other hand, if he says, okay, if I'm in that kind of a condition and it looks like there's no hope, then don't prolong it. Take me off. Let me go. Let me die naturally. Then he sits his kids down and he tells it, and here's his healthcare power of attorney. He says, and John, you're the one that I'm calling on to make the decisions for me. Sue, you listen to him because I put him here to call. And you know what he's done? He's just headed off. There may be, she may feel offended that she chose him over her. You know how some people are. They'll fight about anything. But he's done his best. And I think probably just headed out off the disaster by doing that. So simple. I mean, you could sit down and do that in 15 minutes.
And a lot of hospitals today will ask you specifically when you're going in for just any kind of surgery, do you have a living will and do you have a health care power of attorney? We'd like you to have copies with you. They're not anticipating your death, but they are thinking ahead. If you do go into some kind of problem on the table, what
yeah.
are we going to do about it?
Right. This points to another problem, and that is, although they ask for it, they do nothing to educate people. So if you come in and you say no, and you're 85, and they say, do you have a health care power of attorney? And you say no, next question. So there's no effort. They fulfilled the letter of the law, the Joint Commission of Hospital Accreditation, they ask. But there's no effort to educate people and let them know or let them make an informed decision about it. So this healthcare power of attorney, you need to have that. But then there's this other issue, and this is what's called code status. This is in Ohio, that if your heart stops, no matter where you are, the healthcare system is obligated to try to resuscitate you unless you don't want that. Unless you don't want that. So if you have a living will and you're in a permanently unconscious state or you have a terminal condition, then if you designated you didn't want it, you wouldn't get resuscitated, okay? But here's the scenario we face all the time, is the 85-year-old person that has dementia, that's in a nursing home. It's not severe dementia maybe, but they don't have a terminal condition. Maybe they even have a living will, but they need to designate, if they're the kind of person that wouldn't want these kind of measures, then in Ohio you have to designate code status and say DNR, do not resuscitate. See, so that's a whole nother realm. You can see why this is, it's complicated and it's hard for people to get. Yeah.
So I'm sure this is what I'm thinking, but for your instance, if someone went into a surgery and they didn't have a do not resuscitate card, they would automatically try to resuscitate.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
How do they know? Would they always ask you?
Well, they should ask you when you go in. And frankly, when it comes to surgery, because with anesthesia and that kind of thing, things can go wrong where they can make a quick resuscitation. And most of the time, they even rescind DNRs during surgery. They'll ask patients. You know, I've had patients that are, you know, I make this designation between dementia and non-dementia because I think it's really important, because I think a lot of people feel like if they had dementia, their mind is not, it's not them. They're a lot more prone to say, I wouldn't want a lot of care. But I mean, I see people come in that are 80 years old, they're functional, they're getting around, they're doing really well, and they come in and they have a DNR, but they're having a heart attack. Well, if somebody's having a heart attack, there's a certain rhythm that's pretty easy. One jolt and you can get them back. It's called ventricular fibrillation. And I have encouraged people in that kind of a situation. I said, let's just my recommendation is we hold the DNR. We make you full code. Now, then I understand that if you don't come back and you're on the ventilator, we could pull the plug, or we could, you know, stop care. But I think it would be wise to just try.
But how do you have that conversation with someone who's, you know, if they're having a heart attack, if they're brought in and they're having heart attack?
Okay, well, when I'm saying having a heart attack, myocardial infarction, so that means part of your heart's not getting blood flow. So they may not be in resuscitation. They have chest pain and they're a little short of breath, and so then you can talk to them or you can talk to their family about that. So you see, it's complicated and it's nuanced, and that's why I think the best thing is this healthcare power of attorney. Because then they know what you want and they can speak for you. If you know for sure this code status, but even there are gray areas. So I wish that it was real cut and dry, but here's the thing. We've talked about it for over an hour here, and you see there are still a lot of questions. There are a lot of subtleties to this, and people out there in the general population, most don't have a clue about this. And so, you know, if I had my way, I would approach this as a public health issue. You know, when we look at diabetes, we look at high blood pressure, we look at smoking, we look at high cholesterol. What do people do? Well, the health department, one of the things they do is they help people understand what it is. It's a public health issue, and they follow up and they see and they bring it into schools and colleges and health classes and all these things so that people know. Nobody talks about this. There's not an educational effort. That's what we need, see? We need to have, so that people starting from a very young age, they understand this. And they understand that someday I'm going to have to make these decisions, and they're informed. But we're a long way from that right now.
The government doesn't want
us to know. I don't know.
Since you were talking about more senior people, you know, that could be part of it. But I agree. I think education on these issues is the best thing that you could do, right along with, you know, we always think, of course, of wanting to be healthy and doing everything we can. But when we don't think through these things, then we could get stuck in all kinds of really terrible situations.
Yes, yeah.
For the caregiver, for the decider, and for the person.
Right. This is helpful for both.
Yes.
Both. And then the last thing I want you to think about here is this whole matter with nursing home patients. Whenever someone goes into the nursing home, they're going to ask these questions about level of care. And one thing that most people don't know is that they can designate this. It's do not hospitalize. But you have to designate that. Otherwise, when they get sick, they're going to go to the hospital. Now, if it's the kind of thing where there is a condition like pain or suffering that they cannot manage in the nursing home, then you can override this and say, yeah, they need to go to the hospital to manage their symptoms. But, you know, for the people with terminal dementia, I think this is totally appropriate. Or they have some other terminal disease, you realize this is the end. Then don't take them back and forth to the hospital. It just makes them suffer more. That's my opinion. All right, so what I'm advocating for is starting the conversation. We can do that in the church. We can do it in our families and in our churches. I'll just give you a few ideas. I'd like to discuss something that you need to think about. Have you thought at all about what kind of medical care you'd want at the end of your life? And they may look at you with big eyes and you say, no, I'm not, I don't think you're done. I just would like to talk about this. I heard a lecture about it. I read a book about it. I saw an article in the paper. In fact, David Brooks, I don't know if any of you read the New York Times, he's an op-ed writer. He writes twice a week for the New York Times. And he had it was called Dying in Debt, or Death in Debt, something like that. It was in the New York Times last week. Very well-written piece on this. You could say, I read David Brooks, and I thought I'd like to talk to you about this, or have them read it. Because he's talking about this very issue, and he says, because Americans are afraid to talk about death, our country will go broke. Okay? So it's good to see in the popular press people are starting to understand this. Tell them you want them to have the facts. You want them to be able to make informed decision. Do you have a living will? That's a good place to start. Would you like to make one? You can get these online. I'll give you a website here. I encourage you to discuss your wishes with your family. So if you're in a pastoral position, you have this discussion and say, you need to go talk to your family. Call a family meeting. Get them all there around the holidays. It's not going to be a bummer. It's the right thing to do for your family. Here's this website. It's caringinfo.org. This is the website for the American, it's like the hospice and palliative care. This is the best thing out there, I think. Because here, see, it says, are you planning ahead? Are you caring for someone? Are you living with an illness? Are you grieving a loss? Each one of these links to a whole menu of topics. Within this, there is a, see this link? Download your state-specific advance directive. So that's where you can get the living will, healthcare power of attorney for whatever state you're in. I think this website's great. It's the best thing out there as far as I can see. Something that is on the horizon is this this group that's developed these videos out of the Harvard Gerontology Group. They've done studies that shown that they work, they're effective, and I think we might see that coming much more to the fore as well. All right, there's this EOL education. This is just a little blog and information site that I set up, and this is a website for the book that I put together. All right, so any questions? Yeah, Ann?
On the nursing home, my parents are in a nursing home. We have a DNR comfort care. So, mm-hmm. Do you have hospitalized? Is that something additional I should check on?
You should. You should. To be. I mean, do you think it's the kind of thing where they wouldn't want to be hospitalized, just kept comfortable? I mean, if so.
Depends on the,
yeah. Well, you could. You know what you could do? Are you their health care power of attorney?
One of my brothers.
You and your brother should talk about it. This is the way I'd approach it. Mm-hmm. And talk to the people at the nursing home and say you want them to call you before they transport them. Because if they have pneumonia and it looks like this is a terminal event and it's going to be disruptive to them to transport them, then you could say no. If they're they have a compression fracture in their back and they can't get the pain under control, then that would be a different story, maybe. But I would tell them that you don't want them to just, because a lot of times they just pull the trigger on that transport. Okay.
My mother's 93, she's doing great, still drives, mine is fine, but she's in assisted living. But if we had one of these do not hospitalize, is it paperwork? Is it something, a legal piece of paper that
that facility, they would have to have that.
Okay, so then if it says do not hospitalize, they have to abide by that? Assisted living where she's
if you have a legal document that says that, yeah.
Okay. They couldn't argue with us. You know, we want her to go to the hospital.
Well, I can't say that they couldn't, but they shouldn't.
Okay.
I mean, if you have and have executed it with them.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. Well, thanks, everybody.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.